Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome you to Amherst Pierrepont's 2022 Outlook Call on Investment Grade Corporate Bonds. My name is Meredith Contenti, and I'm one of the Investment Grade Strategists. Today, I'll be joined by the Head of Strategy, Steve Abrahams, our Chief Economist, Stephen Stanley, as well as Dan Bruzzo, who is my fellow credit strategist on the Investment Grade side. We each have some prepared remarks over the next 30 minutes, and then we will open up the call to Q&A. You should see on the right side of your webinar screen a chat box where you can write and submit a question. That is where you can ask questions, which I will relay to the panel. You can submit a question at any time during the discussion, but we'll turn to audience questions after we wrap up the prepared remarks. So without further ado, I'd like to turn the call over to Steve Abrahams. Steve, the floor is yours.
All right. Thanks so much, Meredith, and good afternoon, everyone. So I wanted to focus just for the next few minutes or so on some of the macro issues that we see sitting ahead of us in 2022. And I really wanted to concentrate on two in particular, the risk of much higher volatility in the markets for next year, and then the issue of falling risk-adjusted returns and a much flatter spread curve for next year as well. There's some other things, obviously, but I think these are probably the two most important when it comes to all markets, investment-grade credit included. So let's talk a little bit first about volatility. And the way that the volatility market is priced now just seems like it is missing the mark in some very important respects. First of all, if you look at just a couple of the broad stroke fundamentals, the range of possible outcomes next year for rates, for spreads, seems much wider than it did in 2020. And there's a couple of major contributions to that. First, let's talk about the Fed. The potential for a much wider range of outcomes in Fed policy in 2021 is much greater than it was in 2020. In 2020, the Fed was very resolute, essentially sticking close to the zero lower bound and then starting to signal the taper that we have just started getting underway. But next year, we're likely to see much more recalibration of Fed policy as a number of circumstances evolve. For one thing, a lot has changed since the Fed really tapered for the first and only time, which it did through most of 2014. And probably the most important thing that has changed is actually the Fed itself. You'll remember that in Jackson Hole in 2020, the Fed basically rolled out its flexible average inflation targeting framework. And under that framework, it's trying to get to its 2% target on average, which means it's willing to let the economy run hot and willing to let inflation run way above that 2% target in order to compensate for long stretches of time, especially in the last 10 years or so, when inflation has fallen short of target despite the best efforts by the Fed. Now, the interesting thing about FAIT, or that flexible average inflation target, is that it's set up a pretty significant challenge for the Fed. Core PCE was greater than 2% only really twice between 2008 and 2020, and now it is running well above 2.5%. So the Fed is going to have to wrangle inflation back to target. The other thing that's changed that is sitting in front of the Fed is an economy that's different, very different in some respects from the way it was in 2014, and some of that is just the economy coming out of pandemic. We have a much different mix of contributions to GDP, a much more significant contribution from goods than we had pre-pandemic, so that has changed. We have a labor market where labor market participation is down, and we're still trying to figure out what is going to be the magic that will bring it back. I know Stephen Stanley has thoughts on that. But beyond that, we also have a much different picture when it comes to international trade and supply lines. And that was a trend that really predated the pandemic. Again, the Fed is going to have to navigate the economy with a set of policy guidelines that are different than the last time we tapered. And then obviously the other thing that has changed is the evolving risk from the pandemic. And this latest little episode from Omicron is just a preview of what that can look like. We had a very interesting call yesterday that included an infectious disease specialist, and we talk a lot about the long tail of variants that sits in front of us as well. So the market is really ripe for policy recalibration. We got a hint of that with Powell's testimony before Congress within the last week or so, where he really was restriking the timeline for taper. And remember, we still have the discussion of how fast and how far the Fed might hike. The other thing that is going to change next year is the handoff of market power from the Fed to private capital. Obviously, with taper, the Fed is going to step back from its aggressive buying. It's not going to renormalize yet, but it certainly is going to step by from its buying. And private capital is going to have a bigger role in how assets get priced and repriced. And one clear thing about private capital, it has a lot more and a lot more conflicting objectives than the Fed. And it doesn't usually hold press conferences to say what it's going to do next. So there's plenty of room for the market to be surprised by changing asset allocation and changing asset liability management from some major investors. The third thing that could be a contribution to volatility is going to be the larger loan balances that are going to start to emerge in the agency MBS market. They will increase by, I believe, around 18% next year, so there could be more volatility transmitted after MBS. So that's kind of the fundamentals. If you look at the vol market, forward vol actually declines going forward, and that just seems like it's off the mark. So there are a number of strategies that investors can use to try to position for higher volatility. Obviously, risk spreads tend to widen as volatility picks up. So the trick may be to move up in credit, but try to add some of the spread back by doing that in smaller or less liquid names where you're going to get compensated for some of that liquidity risk. That could reduce your spread delta or spread exposure, but still allow you to hit income or revenue targets. Then finally, I want to talk briefly about falling risk-adjusted returns and a flatter spread curve. As I mentioned, there's good reason to believe fundamental risks are going to go up. But still, we're likely to see historic amounts of cash, not just next year, really, but for years to come. That's partly from the Fed. Remember, through taper, the Fed continues to pump cash into the economy. And then we're not going to see the Fed draw down its portfolio until it starts to renormalize its balance sheet. And that could start only after potentially 2024, so a few years off. And renormalization can be a long and steady process there. At the end of renormalization, we're still likely to see a banking sector with tremendous amounts of cash, much more excess reserves than we saw under the previous regime. And so that's going to be a huge source of pressure on spreads going forward. Now, the market to some degree is already priced for that. Real rates in 5 years, 10 years, 30 years, are near historic lows, and those real rates, again, are signals that the market's expecting a tremendous supply of cash, at least far in excess of what we'd see in terms of demand to borrow. And then if you look at risk assets today, whether you're looking at term premiums in the Treasury market, OAS on mortgage-backed securities, or spreads in IG and high yield where the spread curve is already flattened. The market is already anticipating some of that, but I think it's under-anticipating what we're going to see there. So those are probably the two biggest macro themes that we see for next year. I know Meredith and I have a friendly difference of opinion on what inflation will do in credit. I'm kind of approaching it from a macro standpoint where at least history would suggest that the revenue line in corporate income statements tends to move up with inflation faster than costs do. We've certainly seen record corporate profits, which suggests that's the case. I know Meredith is looking at it from a balance sheet perspective and can find plenty of examples where that does not hold, so I think it's going to be a credit picker's market to avoid the ill effects of inflation. We're expecting strong markets in private credit because banks are still cautious about lending. And then there's a host of niche issues around SOFR, increased focus on climate from regulators, which could raise capital requirements for some portfolios. And there's always crypto lurking in the background, but that's mainly going to be an issue potentially for banks. But those are the macro themes that we see for next year. And I will leave it there and hand it back to Meredith.
Great. Thank you so much, Steve. Okay, moving on, we're going to turn it over to Stephen Stanley, who's going to talk a little bit about the economy. Stephen Stanley?
Thanks, Meredith, and good afternoon, everyone. One of the big themes throughout 2021 was the supply disruptions in the economy, the bottlenecks that developed, which hurt growth in some sectors, and in particular drove inflation in a number of sectors. And I think there's a broad, as we move toward 2022, there's a broad consensus around the idea that these bottlenecks are going to dissipate in the coming year and that the economy is going to kind of return to normal, if you will, in a sense that inflation should come down and fewer sectors are going to be constrained by shortages of key materials, of labor, and a variety of the other bottlenecks that have hit. And one of the themes that I think could surprise people in 2022 is that the economy may continue to overheat. I believe that not only has supply been constrained to some degree by disruptions around the pandemic, but demand has been extraordinarily strong, both from consumers and businesses. And that, in my view, is likely to continue into 2022. We know that the in the aggregate, household balance sheets and corporate balance sheets are in fantastic shape, and in particular, households are sitting on trillions of dollars of excess liquidity that they amassed during the pandemic, and that is just waiting to be spent as the economy normalizes. So I would give you one example of a what I view as a purely supply-side bottleneck that has plagued the economy this year, and one that is that looks like a supply bottleneck but may, in fact, reflect, at least in part, strong demand. So the pure supply-side bottleneck that I would point to is the auto sector, and we know that automakers have suffered from a shortage of chips, key computer chips, going all the way back to 2020 and certainly through all of this year, and as a result, auto assemblies have dropped over the course of the year, have been very low, and we've had big shortages in both new and used vehicles, which, of course, has driven up vehicle prices quite dramatically. As 2021 draws to a close, those chip supplies are finally beginning to pick up, and auto assemblies have been creeping higher recently. So there is hope that that one will resolve itself over the course of 2022. I do think that auto production should get back to normal over the course of next year, not all at once, but over the course of the year. And hopefully that will relieve some of the pressure on automakers from a supply perspective, beefing inventories back up, hopefully normalizing a little bit on the price front as well. However, I would give you a contraexample, which is the port situation. I think everyone's familiar with the backups in the ports, particularly on the West Coast, all the ships that are just sitting out in the ocean waiting for their chance to be unloaded. We've heard about shortages of drivers. We can't get the goods where they need to be. We can't get the shipping containers into the right place at the right time. And I think that one looks like a supply constraint and may very well be caused at least partially by some of the bottlenecks incurred because of the pandemic. But at the end of the day, it's really a demand issue. We've seen an unprecedented demand for goods by retailers and wholesalers moving into the holiday season. So the peak shipping season was busier than it's ever been. and the system may or may not have been running near full capacity, but even at full capacity, I just don't think that it would have been able to handle the flow of goods that that would be required by this strong demand that we've seen from the consumer. And I would give two facts to kind of back that up. One is we saw just yesterday on CNBC, the manager of the ports of LA and Long Beach, and he made exactly that point. He said, look, you know, we can do everything we can do to try to make things more efficient and streamline the unloading process, but the reality is that the volume of goods that we're trying to push through our ports is just more than we can handle right now. And then the other thing is you can look at the payroll numbers as it relates to truck drivers, because everybody says there's a driver shortage. And indeed, we don't have enough drivers to get the goods where they need to be. But if you look at payrolls, the truck transportation category is running roughly where it was in February 2020. And so what we're seeing there is, yes, we don't have enough drivers, but it's not because there's a supply shortage of drivers. It's simply because the demand has moved up so much, and we haven't been able to keep up in terms of hiring. So to the extent that consumer demand remains strong next year, I think that some of these bottlenecks are likely to persist a little longer than people think. Moving on to the next theme, I would make a similar case as it relates to workers, because labor shortage has been another piece of the puzzle this year that has contributed to inflation as well as restraining the economy. And I think there we all thought that the bottleneck would ease in the fall with the end of supplemental unemployment benefits, with kids going back to school, freeing up a lot of caretakers and young parents to go back to the labor market, and with health concerns hopefully diminishing as more people get vaccinated. There was a general sense that the supply of workers would start to pick up as we moved into the fall. And it looks like we're finally getting evidence of that. The November employment report included a big increase in labor force participation. On the household survey side, many more people got jobs than entered the labor force. So the labor market is still very tight. We saw that again with the JOLTS data today and job openings moving to yet another record high in October. We're also seeing a little bit in some of the surveys of businesses. They're still complaining widely about a shortage of qualified workers, but they are at the margin starting to see a little better luck at finding people to bring on. So I do think we're going to see a little bit of relief there. But I think we could very well get to full employment by early next year, maybe by the end of the first quarter, let's say, where the unemployment rate is running at or below 4% and labor force participation is pretty close to, what I would calculate as an equilibrium level. And I think when we get to that point, the economy is still going to need more workers because, again, growth has been very strong, and firms need a higher level of workers to keep up with demand. And so I think that the labor market situation is going to continue to run hot with demand exceeding supply, which probably means ongoing steep wage increases, and that will contribute into inflation. So that would turn me to my next theme, which is inflation. And as you can imagine from the first two points, I do think inflation may cool in 2022 as some of these supply bottlenecks abate. And I gave motor vehicles as a good example of that. But overall, I would expect that inflation is going to continue to run pretty hot. So it may not be running, 5, 6, 7% throughout 2022. But I also doubt that we're going to see anything close to the Fed's 2% target. Maybe we're running in the threes by the second half of 2022. And that leads me to my final point, which would be on the Fed. And here I think the Fed is beginning to realize that they need to play catch-up. They've allowed themselves to fall behind the curve. They're just starting to catch up. They seem to be kind of rushing to get asset purchases done, and it looks like we're going to get an announcement next week that they're going to double the pace of reduction or double the pace of tapering, which will get them to a point where asset purchases will probably be done in March, and that will allow them, that will clear the decks for rate hikes as needed beginning in the spring. the market has moved an awful lot in regards to the near-term monetary policy outlook. If you go back to the early part of this year, you know, a lot of people thought that the Fed wasn't going to be lifting off until 2024. And of course, things have changed dramatically now. Fed funds futures basically have 3/4-point hikes priced in by the end of 2022, which is roughly in line with what I'm expecting. However, the longer end or the longer-term monetary policy expectations really haven't changed yet. If you look at Eurodollar futures or SOFR futures going out multiple years, what they suggest is that the markets think that the upcoming hike cycle is probably going to end at around 1.5. So the Fed's going to be busy next year, but by the end of next year, it's, you know, pretty well on its way to being done. Of course, the Fed itself thinks that a neutral funds rate is 2.5. So what the market is saying is that the economy must be very fragile and is not going to be able to handle anything close to neutral rates, much less a move into restrictive territory. I think that may be the next shoe to drop, and in some ways the final shoe to drop as it relates to the expectations around Fed policy as we move into 2022. At some point, especially once the Fed begins to raise rates, and if inflation doesn't react right away, and I think there's a chance that it remains stubbornly high, you know, people may begin to revisit that idea about where the terminal rate is going to be for this cycle, and may start to think about something that's a little bit more historically normal for the rate cycle. And with that, I will turn it back over to Meredith.
Thanks, Stephen. All right, so now we're going to be moving on to the credit portion of our call, and I'm going to turn the call over to Dan Bruzzo to kick us off.
Hey, thanks, Meredith. Once again, for this year's outlook, Meredith and I were tasked with identifying some out-of-consensus calls for the upcoming year. So the idea is being to seek out themes that the broader market might be undervaluing or mispricing for 2022. Those concepts are laid out here in slide 4, each of which we'll go into in greater detail in this presentation. Next. The first of these calls is one of the more macro predictions we have for the broader market. Last year, we predicted that gross volume for the IG new issue market would fall about 15-20% off the lofty level that we saw of $1.9 trillion in 2020. With less than 3 weeks remaining in 21, it appears the market will hit the lower end of that range with a projected $1.5 trillion in gross volume for the current year. As street estimates for supply begin to be published over the next couple of weeks, we're expecting that most of those predictions will call for a rather sharp drop-off in IG issuance for the coming year. Meanwhile, our expectation for 22 is that gross issuance will actually only fall about 5% off the current year gross, which projects to be about $1.425 trillion, which would still be tracking pretty well above what we saw in a typical year prior to the pandemic. On the next slide, we demonstrate that gross issuance in the first graphic with our projection for the next year highlighted at the top of the page. If we move down the page a little bit, you see the upcoming maturities for the broad IG market spread out over the past 3 years. I know there's a lot of numbers here, but really what we're just trying to capture is the extent to which issuers have been utilizing this market to pay down upcoming debt maturities, which ultimately influences the net figure of total debt that's hitting the market. So aggregate 3-year maturities as of year end are about $2.7 trillion. That remains relatively flat from the prior year end, but still, we're about $170 billion lower than we were at year-end 2019. So that demonstrates the extent to which IG issuers have really been utilizing this public debt market over the past 2 years to pre-fund their upcoming maturities and then term out their debt structures. So we expect this type of issuance will undoubtedly continue and still should make up the bulk of new issue in the coming year. However, we're expecting that a greater portion of new debt hitting the market in 22 should be directed to other sources, and these include debt-funded M&A, debt-funded share repurchases, and any other purpose really that contributes to the level of net debt on balance sheets, net leverage. This is relevant as it directly influences the net level of available debt trading in the secondary market more so than we're just seeing what we're seeing with the gross. Okay, and that brings us to the next slide, which will be our next out-of-consensus call for 22, so I'll pass the call over to Meredith.
Thanks, Dan. All right, so over the past few months, if you look at slide 7, you'll see the IG credit market has seen a huge flight to quality trade. We've seen more single A and double A money being put to work. And these curves are now compressed. There's very little yield pickup within the front and the back end of the curves. So as we look into 2022, we think the need for yield will prevail, especially if the Fed is slow to move on rates. And it will have investors looking to move down the ratings curve in search for yield. We think fallen angel risk is in BBB credit is lower now than it was at the start of the pandemic. Most investment grade credits in our universe use the pandemic to issue debt and improve liquidity. But most of that debt has been repaid. And shareholder rewards were largely suspended, which helped to build cash positions. So that said, balance sheets are in better shape today than they were at the start of the pandemic. And then balance sheet repositioning in 2021 has led to lower weighted average coupons as well as longer weighted average maturities. So any rebound in EBITDA kind of improves credit metrics to levels better than they were in March of 2020. And this provides less downside ratings risk than at the start of the pandemic. S&P recently put out a credit trend report, and it discussed potential downgrades versus upgrades. So if you turn to, when we turn to slide 8, if you look at the top graph, this highlights that the gap between downgrades and upgrades is at the lowest level since February 2019. The number of potential downgrades has actually decreased for 14 consecutive months, which underscores the balance sheet repair progress that was made during the pandemic. And if you look at the second graph on slide 8, it shows the sectors that have the least downside risk in the BBB space, and that includes healthcare, capital goods, insurance, metals and mining, and aerospace and defense. These are the sectors that investors can feel the most comfortable with when moving into the BBB category, given the lower fallen angel risk. One of the trades we were recommending for 2022 is in the healthcare space, and this is a swap out of Medtronic and into CVS. We like this trade in the 2035 bonds as it provides for a pickup of over 60 basis points while taking out 2 points of premium. CVS continues to be in debt reduction mode from the Aetna acquisition and remains committed to a leverage ratio in the low 3x area, and it's fastly approaching that leverage metric. And when we compare it to Medtronic, Medtronic's leverage is not too far off CVS's target at 2.6x, and Medtronic actually has single A ratings. So furthermore, CVS has a capital structure that's more liquid and more bonds, which makes it easier to source and makes it easier to also build a position in the credit. On the capital goods side, we view a trade out of Honeywell into Dover as attractive, particularly in the 20-year part of the curve. Both credits have similar margin and credit profiles, and both continue to view tuck-in acquisitions as a source of growth. We think Dover's ratings are only constrained by its size, as it generates less than $10 billion in revenues annually. But its total leverage is actually a full turn lower than Honeywell's. In the 20-year part of the curve, Dover trades roughly 50 basis points behind Honeywell. And with that, I'm going to turn it back to Dan.
Okay, thanks, Meredith. When I spoke earlier about net supply, one of the key factors that I said would be influencing both total issuance and aggregate net leverage figures is the amount of debt-funded M&A that we expect to see in the coming year. In the third quarter of this year, we saw global M&A reach its highest quarterly rate since 2017, while global deal count was also at peak levels ever observed in the last quarter. We believe this heightened level of activity is sustainable for the next couple of quarters, and then we can expect to see one of the highest annual rates of activity in 22 ever recorded. As we highlighted earlier, corporate management teams have been using the accommodative debt market to term out upcoming maturities, shore up liquidity profiles. The result has been much stronger overall corporate balance sheets with plenty of capacity to add leverage. The graphics on slide 10 demonstrate that corporate balance sheets are flush with cash as a percentage of total assets is at peak levels versus the past decade. Likewise, net debt to EBITDA of the aggregate S&P 500 is also at the lowest level observed over the past decade, dropping below 1x leverage over the past year. Finally, we demonstrate year-over-year sales growth, a figure that we saw jump in the back months of 20 and throughout some of 21 as cash flows recovered from the depths of the pandemic. Sales growth has been waning over the past few quarters as we resume to a more normal state of operating performance. So when options for organic sales growth start to become limited, We expect that to result in an uptick in M&A, and therefore an uptick in debt issuance to provide funding for these deals. Can you go back to slide 9? There are actually several sectors in the market that we believe are poised for more consolidation. In industrials, both the technology and packaged food segments seem to fit this description. Technology balance sheets are flush with cash. Stock prices are trending toward all-time highs, providing strong acquisition currency. The semiconductor space could seek to combine as chip shortages have caused PEs to hover near the lows, underperforming both software and hardware peers. Meanwhile, in packaged foods, the pandemic proved beneficial as pantry stocking led to stronger top-line and cash flow performances. As these performances start to normalize in the coming year, companies can utilize their improved balance sheets to pursue acquisitions to bolster the top line and improve margins via synergies. In the financial sector, for the past 2 years, we've been highlighting the ongoing trend of mid-size regional bank mergers. We believe U.S. banks with $20 to $100 billion in total assets will continue to draw interest from peer banks as well as larger suitors in both the U.S. and abroad. The insurance and REIT segments have been relatively quiet merger-wise, but a handful of higher-profile deals over the past year could portend some additional activity in 22. So, again, big year for M&A. We think that continues over the next couple of quarters. So, with that, I'm going to pass the call back over to Meredith for a discussion on inflation.
All right. So, I'm moving to slide 11. While the most recent round of earnings results saw a majority of beats on both the top line and EPS, earnings calls were largely centered around the inflation story. And obviously, Stanley spoke about this a little bit in his prepared remarks. More management teams are now expecting inflationary pressure to persist at least through 2022, which negates the transitory narrative. In fact, we've not seen this pace of inflation in the past 20 years, and we think that's caught some management teams off guard, as price hikes have not necessarily kept up with the pace of inflation. Additionally, most companies used the height of the pandemic to execute significant cost cuts, as there was just no way to predict how long lockdowns were going to last. That said, we think it's going to be harder to use cost-cutting as an effective inflation management tool, as the majority of the low-hanging fruit is gone and wages are actually on the rise. So 2021 was essentially a one-way trade tighter in the investment-grade spreads, and investment-grade spreads are close to pre-pandemic levels and with limited spread differentiation between credits. We note that the IG CDX index is only 9 basis points wider than where it was on January 2nd, 2020, even with the most recent round of volatility that we've seen. And we think volatility is likely to tick up this year as inflation creeps higher, which should bring relative value back into focus. We think companies that were more aggressive on price hikes will have an easier time managing their margin profiles, as multiple price hikes may be harder to execute as 2022 progresses. Moving to the next slide, we have 4 sector-specific trade ideas that we highlight certain credits that are managing inflation better than their respective peers. We used a 2-year comparison as we felt it was better to compare to a quarter at the height of the pandemic because it was not an accurate representation of margins. And so in the essence of time, I'm going to discuss 2 of the most compelling trade ideas. The first is a sale of Stanley Black & Decker into Whirlpool. Whirlpool posted strong margin expansion and maintains a long track record of stable profitability and credit metrics throughout cycles. Its recent margin expansion is actually largely due to its cost-based pricing model and low fixed cost base, which enables the company to manage operating costs efficiently to offset raw material inflation. That said, Whirlpool is now delivering EBIT margins above their long-term target. We think a swap out of Stanley into Whirlpool is attractive as it provides for a pickup of nearly 30 basis points. The next and most compelling trade is a swap out of Kimberly-Clark and into Estee Lauder. Kimberly-Clark's most recent results were negatively impacted by significant cost inflation, while Estee Lauder was more than able to fully offset this inflation on the operating side. Even with higher ratings, Estee Lauder still trades behind Kimberly-Clark at roughly 10 basis points or so. And we think demand for Estee Lauder products will continue to increase as the economy begins to recover. Estee Lauder also boasts a much stronger and more liquid balance sheet, which underscores our positive view of the credit. For more information on our other trade ideas, please refer to our Outlook piece which was published prior to the Thanksgiving holiday. And now I'll turn it back to Dan.
Okay, thanks, Meredith. This next section reflects our views on the banking sector, more specifically how appetite for yield should continue to push investors into subordinated structures, both in domestic and Yankee banks abroad. The banking sector has significantly underperformed the broad IG corporate bond index in 21 year to date, with one of the lowest credit returns in the overall index. We've held a market weight on the sector and continue to do so as we enter 22, with a preference for large money center banks and Yankees over large domestic regionals. Furthermore, we see better opportunity for investors to target down in structure trading strategies, including trades into subordinated Tier 2 and Tier 1 structures, as well as preferred securities as liquidity permits. In the second half of 21, we saw an uptick in preferred issuance, and while spreads may be near the historical tights versus their respective senior securities, we believe preferreds and sub-debt will continue to outperform senior structures, in particular in the first two quarters of 22. Next slide. Okay, we recognize that in Yankee banks, spreads of subs versus seniors have been pushing up against historic tights. Slide 14 depicts the ITRAC Senior Financial Credit Index versus the subordinated. And while these measures might be tight, credit curves in general, in particular the banking sector, remain extraordinarily flat. So we expect investors will be less inclined to take on additional duration risk and will instead continue to seek out opportunities to move down in structure in search for yield. One of the trends we expect to pick up in 22 is the issuance of Tier 2 debt among the big six U.S. money center banks. Issuance of Tier 2 subs hit a peak in the period between 2013 and 16, but it's been relatively quiet over the past couple of years. Now that a lot of that debt that was issued during that period is approaching its amortization period, which is when it gradually loses qualification as regulatory loss-absorbing capital, we think the big banks will seek to either refinance or at least issue some more of this Tier 2 debt in the coming year. So the only issue is demand will very likely continue to outstrip that new supply, with investors likely targeting these new deals very aggressively. Go back to 13. With that in mind, we think investors should look to move even further down the cap structure domestically, consider some of the preferred debt securities that the banks have been issuing over the past 3 years. There's a very strong indirect correlation between the floating rate back-end spread and the available yield to call on these securities, which of course makes sense as it directly relates to the amount of rate protection afforded in the structure. But the more recent issues have had very small back-ends, and that's being reflected in current yields. So what we think is that the relative value sweet spot for investors in the secondary market is to consider targeting some of the recent issues with mid-range back-end spreads. We believe these offer the best mix of spread over seniors and rate protection. The ones that we see value in are mostly being issued out of the big money center banks. What we're looking for are issues outstanding with low 300 basis point back-ends, which are offering anywhere from the mid 3 to 4% yields. And most of these are currently trading with a G-spread pick of the mid 200s over their relative senior five-year securities, which, again, it's low historically, but we still see this as offering good risk compensation to investors relative to what's available in the broad IG market. So with that, I'm going to pass the call back over to Meredith.
Great. Thanks, Dan. And my last out-of-consensus call is that the consumer is going to be in a weaker position in 2022. So looking at slide 15, given that we think inflation is going to persist through the year, we believe it will put the consumer in a weaker position as greater percentage of budgets go to non-discretionary items. Price hikes on items like food, which is up 40% since the lockdown started, will only limit the consumer's spending ability as the year progresses. And as the world fully reopens, consumers will need to go back to spending on things like commuting. With gasoline prices up roughly 50%, that begins to eat away at monthly budgets. Furthermore, consumer sentiment is actually lower now than it was at the start of the pandemic, and it continues to fall, which we think is telling and opposite from the media rhetoric. That said, we believe more consumers will need to make the dollar stretch, making mass merchants, off-price retailers, and dollar stores the beneficiaries. Starting with dollar stores. While we recognize that both Dollar Tree and Dollar General don't have very large capital structures, we do view their bonds as core holds in inflationary environments. The value proposition of dollar stores is very compelling, even with dollar stores looking to raise prices by up to 25 cents. They provide an alternative to grocery stores for both perishable and non-perishable food items. And honestly, recent channel checks at certain dollar stores in the tri-state area, I've found that the majority shoppers are using these stores more as an alternative to grocery stores. We're seeing more and more people looking to do most of their grocery shopping now at dollar stores, again, to make their monthly budget stretch. So we prefer the Dollar Tree credit in the 10-year part of the curve as it trades about 15 basis points behind Dollar General, and it's also committed to maintaining a stronger leverage metric than Dollar General, and that's about a half a turn tighter. Looking at the next slide, in the off-price sector, Ross Stores remains our top pick. Investors have historically kind of shied away from the 30-year brick-and-mortar paper, but the pandemic has taught us that brick-and-mortar is just not dead, something we discussed in last year's Outlook call. Even without an online presence, Ross Stores sales are now above pre-pandemic levels and are expected to grow 48% this year. We note that Ross Stores 30-year paper is hard to source, especially since the company's tendered for some. But at 160 basis points, we view them as attractive. And furthermore, in the 10-year part of the curve, Ross trades about 30 basis points behind TJ Maxx. And we think that this relationship will collapse closer to about 10 basis points. Lastly, I want to highlight Kohl's. Department stores are not usually the place to make the dollar stretch, but when it comes to bargains, Kohl's promotional strategy may serve them well. They had Black Friday deals that ran mostly through the month of November, and their Kohl's cash promotion rewards customers with money off for their next purchase, which helps to boost traffic. Additionally, the company accepts returns from Amazon, which is another great traffic strategy, and provides those returning items with a $5 off coupon. And given their conservative balance sheet and continued focus on debt reduction, Kohl's was the only department store to hold on to their investment grade ratings from the disruption caused by the pandemic. Margins are expected to end the year higher than they were pre-pandemic, which means the company is managing inventory well, a problem that they had in the past. Kohl's 10-year bond is one of the widest trading IG retail bonds at roughly 58 basis points, and the only bond in their capital structure that has not been tendered. And if you can source the 2045 bonds, we also view them as attractive, as they are the widest trading bond in the IG retail sector. So this concludes our prepared remarks, and at this time, we're going to queue up for some questions. Just hold tight as we have some questions come in. All right. First question, it looks like it's coming in for Dan. Said you mentioned preferred issues from U.S. money centers as one of the segments you're targeting in domestic banks. What are some areas you like in Yankee Bank subs?
Okay, thanks. In Yankee Banks, definitely one area where we see good value is the big four Australian banks, subordinated Tier 2 debt issues. The banks themselves are definitely fundamentally sound, extremely well capitalized with AA ratings from Moody's and S&P. But the reason we like the structure is that according to Australian bank law, as laid out by APRA, Tier 2 debt is actually the only debt that qualifies as TLAC eligible, or the senior most that qualifies as TLAC eligible. So that's unlike most other banking regimes where there's a third tier or Tier 3 of eligible debt, which is typically either senior non-preferred debt or senior holding company debt, depending on the regime that you're in. This Aussie sub-debt is actually rated six notches below senior bank, so they're at the BAA1 triple B plus level for all four of the big banks, the big pillar banks. But again, this debt isn't subordinated to another senior tier of debt that qualifies as TLAC. As an example, you can look at 10-year Commonwealth Bank of Australia, CBAAU, sub-papers trading about 135, 140 to the curve. And that compares with the comparable senior bank paper that's trading about 65 to the curve. So really you're looking at, you know, what's effectively a 65 to 70 basis point pick in the 10-year part of the curve to effectively only move down what I see as one level in the capital structure. which, you know, again, the same as we're seeing domestically, that relationship is tight historically. But these are the trades that we see as attractive relative to what is increasingly limited opportunity set in the IG corporate credit market. So.
Okay, great. Thanks, Dan. All right. We have one more question. I think this is for me. This says, does the recent activist investor news on coal weigh into your recommendation? Well, as we mentioned during the prepared remarks, we did publish our Outlook piece prior to the news of Engine Capital accumulating a 1% stake in Kohl's. It's something that I am monitoring closely. Right now, Engine Capital is recommending that the board either look to sell the company as a whole or spin or sell the e-commerce business from the brick-and-mortar business, kind of similar to what we saw Saks do earlier this year. Interestingly enough, Kohl's has actually pushed back on activist investor pressure in the past. There had been multiple attempts to get them to monetize their real estate portfolio, which they did not do. They had looked at in the past and valued in the past and thought it was just not an attractive valuation for them and didn't make any sense for them. And they've also made significant strides in addressing inventory issues, which I mentioned earlier, which has really helped margins a lot. And that was one of the things that they were struggling with. And so the fact that their margins are now better than pre-pandemic levels is a testament to the better inventory management. I also mentioned the Amazon partnership earlier, and that's been a very successful strategy to drive traffic. But, you know, another strategy that they're rolling out right now is the in-store Sephora partnership. And that is a top priority for management. It's not only expected to add about $1 billion in the top line, but it's going to help to attract a newer and younger demographic to the store base. And stores that have added the Sephora in-store, the Sephora in-store have witnessed incremental sales gains in about the mid-single-digit area. So that's a very compelling strategy for them. You know, the other thing, too, to note, and this is why I also like the Estee Lauder credit, beauty products just tend to carry higher margins than, say, apparel. So beauty products tend to carry margins in the mid-teens area, where apparel is somewhere in the mid to high single digits. So this should give a boost to Kohl's overall margin profile, which, again, is a positive. So right now, I'm keeping my recommendation as is. I still like Kohl's bonds. I still think they're attractive. I will continue to monitor the activist headlines, but I'm not changing my recommendation. I think that this could just be very fleeting and they could push back as they've done in the past. All right, and I think that's it for questions. So I want to thank you all for dialing in and joining us today. There will be a replay of this call, and we'll send out a link shortly to all of those who have registered. Thank you again for joining us, and hope you have a great day.